Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Hurricane Katrina tore up the Gulf Coast and the levees of New Orleans last week, it also laid bare a deep fault line in American life and the American South between haves and have-nots. Raw poverty was thrust into American television screens in volume for days and in extreme distress. It was black and white, but the overwhelming number of faces we saw in desperate straits last week belonged to people of color. One of our guests today, the Reverend Calvin Butts, has said that if the hurricane had struck a white middle-class neighborhood in the Northeast, the government response would have been stronger and swifter. But American poverty, largely ignored now for years, is so pronounced that a storm would have a hard time missing it. As Katrina was rolling north last week, the U.S. Census Bureau released new numbers showing more national poverty, and the whole South, black and white, hit hard. This hour, On Point, race and poverty in the path of Katrina. First, we begin in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Joining me is Christopher Rooks. He's a program officer for the humanitarian organization Mercy Corps. He's been working at a Baptist church there in Baton Rouge, helping people displaced from their homes by Hurricane Katrina. Christopher Rooks, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You're 28 years old. You're down there in the midst of a big disaster. We're talking about race and poverty. Are those showing up as you deliver relief to the folks hit by Hurricane Katrina? Those issues.
Those issues are pretty clear that the majority of the people that have been evacuated are African American. Not exclusively, I think it should be made clear. I think it's also important to point out that the racial issue can be overstated. There are tensions. We've heard reports of tensions. However, I think that any time people are evacuated under such conditions, you know, there's going to be a lot of internal tension that they're going to have to deal with. And so there's a certain element of race. There's also an element of natural distress that could be coming out.
You're handing out blankets, clothing, food, nutritional supplements there. What are people coming to you with? Is it just the shirts on their backs?
Largely, and their families on their backs, too. We encountered one family where a grandmother, a mother, and two children, one of whom was 3 weeks old, had walked or hitchhiked from Baton Rouge, gone from shelter to shelter, basically been turned away until they got out here to East Baton Rouge and where they were finally brought in. So they really don't have much at all.
Why would anyone be turned away from a shelter in this past week?
Well, it's hard to speak for the shelter operators, but I think that they've been completely overwhelmed, and also there's been again, people are very distressed. There's a certain amount of unrest that we've heard reports of. So I can't speak for exactly why, except to say that it's a very sad thing that they have been.
And, of course, the storm did hit everyone, rich, middle class, and poor. But at the shelter where you're working, at the Baptist Church, is it your sense that it's overwhelmingly poor people coming there for help, or are middle class folks and others, too, in need at this point?
I would say it's what I've seen, it's overwhelmingly poor African-American people that have been displaced.
And their spirits at this point, Chris, as you interact with the people who are picking up blankets and food, are they determined? Are they devastated? What's the morale level there?
Mixed. Some people are clearly devastated, and there's been a lot of psychosocial trauma, which is one of the areas that we're going to be trying to address. One of the ways we're going to do that, our approach is to involve the people that have been displaced in their own recovery, and that's one of the most important things that can be done for them to feel empowered and to feel like their lives are under control. But yes, there's a pretty large degree of distress, although some people are also trying to help their fellow evacuees.
Christopher, you're right there on the front lines in a very, very tough situation. Do you think most Americans carry around in their mind an accurate picture of poverty in this country and its vulnerability?
I can't speak to what most people in America carry around in their minds. Clearly, the poverty level of many of the people that have been displaced is very devastating. And I haven't been to Baton Rouge. I haven't been to New Orleans to see where they lived before. So I think it's pretty horrible.
And there you are, bringing some relief, and we're glad to hear that. Christopher Rooks, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Christopher Rooks, a program officer for Mercy Corps. He joined us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We are talking this hour about race and poverty in the path of Hurricane Katrina and beyond. You can join the conversation. Did Katrina wake you from a dream of coast-to-coast affluence, coast-to-coast decency? Were you stunned by the poverty you saw? It wasn't new. Why was it so shocking? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Atlanta by Reverend Calvin Butts, pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in the city of New York. Reverend Butts, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Athens, Georgia, Robert Pratt, professor of African American history at the University of Georgia, author of We Shall Not Be Moved, The Desegregation of the University of Georgia. Robert Pratt, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Tom. Hello.
Reverend Butts, you've been very outspoken since Katrina tore into the Gulf Coast about the race factor in relief. Relief has begun to come into more people there. Have you settled down, or are you still angry about what you saw?
Oh, I'm still very upset about what I see and what we will continue to see as the days progress. Thank God that relief is coming and that the water is receding and that some people are getting more help. But the revelation, not only for me, but I think for the rest of the country and particularly the world, of the deep poverty that exists in the most affluent nation in the world is enough to drive you to the edge. And I'm at the edge and probably over the edge with anger.
With anger now, about... But you raised the race card in addition to the poverty card.
Well, because largely the poor in this nation are men and women of color, and particularly African American. They are in New Orleans and the surrounding areas hit by Katrina, Mississippi, and Alabama, but they are also and were in developments like the once existing Cabrini Green in Chicago. Mm. They were and are in areas like the Sugar Ditch, where raw sewage flowed through in the Delta. They were and are in other pockets of this nation, and the affluence of this nation and the continual flaunting of our nation's influence tends to camouflage. And as I heard one minister say yesterday, Katrina's wind peeling back the top of the Superdome,
yes,
was like peeling back a scab that revealed a sore that has not healed.
And let me just go to this point. The poverty is undeniable. The new Census Bureau figures are out. Poverty is higher for the fourth year running now. We'll talk more about that. But you really take it beyond that. Do you really think, Calvin Butts, that there is a racial element to the slowness, the bungled relief effort? Do you really think people were sitting around saying, we see black faces in the Superdome, so there's no rush on the food and water?
No, I don't think that we can lay that blame at the feet of all Americans, because as Christopher Rooks pointed out, there are many there who are white, and poverty is something that afflicts blacks as well as whites, but blacks more so. And let me tell you why I think the federal response is as it is and was as it was. There are many in our administration who do look at the situation and see and understand that these are black people and believe that they can wait or they need not do anything or really don't care. I mean, the president flew over the situation, 2,500 feet, 1,000 feet, I don't know, in the air. He was slow coming back from vacation. The New York papers report that Condoleezza, and this is a real rough one, was in New York seeing Spamalot and shopping for shoes. I mean, the administration has this kind of aura about it and deep sense about it that black people really don't count. And therefore, I think, and everyone knows, we could have responded in a much more decisive way, much sooner. In fact, what really makes us angry is, and we are working on suing this administration for civil and criminal neglect, because they knew this condition existed. in fact, passed legislation that allowed for development that exacerbated the condition and then did nothing about it, largely because the people were black and poor.
Reverend Butts in Atlanta, please stand by. Robert Pratt in Athens, Georgia, you're the historian. How do we get to this point?
Well, first of all, let me say thank you for giving me the opportunity to appear on your show. And I would like to say that I have been very pleased with the response of private agencies and private citizens. My wife and I spent much of our day on Saturday at a distribution center in Covington, Georgia, in which we were receiving all kinds of goods and supplies for the victims of Hurricane Katrina. We were joined by lots of people, volunteers mainly, white and black, Hispanic, everybody pulling together. And so I have been very pleased at the national response from private citizens.
And we should say a record pace of giving, $400 million already so far from the entire country. This is not a stingy response.
No. The people have been wonderful, and that is, I think, the one dimension of this entire thing that has really, I think, sort of touched me in many ways. But I have to agree very strongly with all that the Reverend Butts has said. In the immediate hours in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, I watched the federal government's response, or should I say the lack thereof, and I was so somewhat baffled as to why it was so slow.
Robert Pratt, if you'd be good enough, there in Georgia, Calvin Butts in Georgia as well, we have to take a short break here. I want to come back and go deeper into your view of why and what's going on here with both of you. We're talking about race and poverty on the front burner, maybe at last in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. You can join the conversation. Were you stunned by the poverty the storm exposed, by how many of those in desperate straits were people of color? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about race and poverty on the front burner in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Did Katrina pull back the covers on a scandal of racial inequality, of general poverty? And has a storm forced us to look at what's been there all along? What is the message in the crowds of poor black victims of Katrina? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have been joined in this hour from Atlanta by Reverend Calvin Butts. He's pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in the city of New York, president of the Council of Churches of the city of New York. He's in Atlanta for the National Baptist Convention. From Athens, Georgia, we're joined by Robert Pratt, professor of African American history at the University of Georgia, author of We Shall Not Be Moved. Right now, from Lexington, Kentucky, we're joined by James Ziliak. He's professor of economics at the University of Kentucky and director of the Kentucky Center there for Poverty Research. James Ziliak, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Help us understand the national and regional picture here. We see the new figures out as the storm roared across last week from the Census Bureau. It showed a poverty rate up in the United States generally for the fourth year in a row to 12.7% in 2004. Is the South, is the Gulf Coast an even deeper of pocket of poverty than we see nationally?
Yes, most especially. The South has historically had poverty rates above the national level and also higher than within regions, so higher than the West, higher than the Midwest, higher than the East. And then along the Gulf Coast, there's a number of counties that are defined as persistently poor counties. And these are counties that have had poverty rates exceeding 20% each of the last four decennial censuses. And so both the South as a whole, as well as pockets within the South, especially in the Mississippi Delta region, have been areas of high concentration of poverty.
And is this poverty that's always been there, or has it deepened for some reason in recent years?
It is poverty that has always been there. Great gains were made over the last four decades, and you know, looking at the broad trends of poverty. We have reduced poverty in many regions of the country. However, there are some persistently poor areas that have a harder time to make economic advances. And within the last 4 years, after the recession of 2001, many of these areas have seen increases in poverty after the sizable gains we made against poverty in the 1990s.
And why the South in particular in the last 4 years in this recession that Bush pretty much came in with?
Well, I believe that in part it has something to do with the change in the economic structure of the area. Over the last two decades, the South has become more of a manufacturing center for the country, and manufacturing employment took a pretty heavy hit in the early 2000s, and in particular, for example, say the textile industry. And that's had a notable impact on the economic status of families in the South.
And what about the white-black divide, if that's the right way to put it, in the South? Does Southern poverty hit across the spectrum? Is it dramatically more heavily a black problem in this region?
Most especially, it is a national issue, the differences between white and African-American poverty. Nationally, the poverty rate amongst African Americans is nearly three times the size that of white. So this past year, the black poverty rate was 24.7% as opposed to 8.6% for white people. So there's a yawning gap between the races nationally. That's true within the South as well, and along also the Gulf Coast. I think it's salient to point out that Orleans Parish, which is the main county containing New Orleans, has the seventh highest poverty rate this past year amongst the more than 230 counties in the country with more than a quarter million people. And so New Orleans is an area with a very high concentration of poverty, a little over 23%. As compared to, say, the national rate of 12.7%, so it's nearly double the overall national average.
And very much on display in the last week, and pitifully so sometimes. James Ziliak at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
Robert Pratt in Athens, Georgia, we want to understand the history behind this, but we also want to be attuned to exactly what's going on now. I think a lot of Americans had felt that Somehow, while we were all going out about our business, poverty was improving, and race issues were improving. What do we and do we not see exposed in the wake of Katrina here? How do you look at what's been on parade, sadly, in this last week?
I think that Hurricane Katrina did much more than destroy the beautiful city of New Orleans. It also exposed the fault lines of American society, and those fissures are usually defined in terms of race and class. I've heard a lot of discussion, as I'm sure we all have in these past few days, centering on the issue of race and class, and was it a factor in the federal government's inadequate response to this? And there are some who are saying yes, and there are others who are almost incredulous, who are saying, of course, it could not be a factor. There is no way that the federal government could be that callous. But, you know, to me, as someone who has studied black history for many years, it is not totally inconceivable that race could be a factor in this. I don't think that race is necessarily the only factor. I think there are lots of factors that explain the government's inadequate response. But surely, you know, I'm convinced that the fact that these people, most of them, were poor and African-American, probably did play some role in the government's slow response. I mean, there are historical antecedents here. I mean, we look at the Great Flood of 1927 that hit Mississippi and Louisiana. There were tens of thousands of African-Americans. These were civilians who were forced alongside convicts to rebuild the levees at gunpoint. Many people died. Many black people died during the Great Flood of 1927. And so we see the same issue play out again in 2005, right before our very eyes. But even in addition to that, there are many other ways in which race has sort of entered this equation. You look at the fact that, I mean, even the way that people are being evacuated, you have in one instance, and all of these instances have been very widely reported in the media, you have hotel guests, most of whom were white, being evacuated first, while you have poor black people being forced to wait their turn. You have African Americans who are described as being looters, and there is this one image that has gotten a lot of play now. You have a picture of a black man who the caption said looting, but then you have a white couple, and they are finding food and water. Then you have the whole terminology itself. You've got refugees, but these are not refugees. These are evacuees, or these are citizens of the United States. Even in the language, you see the racial coding. I don't want to attribute racial motives to President Bush's administration, but certainly I think the actions of his administration have clearly fueled the perception that race is a factor. There's also the issue of poverty. I think those people who could get out got out. Those who were white, those who were more affluent, those who did not have the financial wherewithal to make the exit were forced to stay behind. And so this is, you know, these are some of the harsh realities, and I hope that if nothing else comes out of this, that even as we watch, I think, slowly over the next several years as the city of New Orleans is rebuilt, and I hope and pray that it will be rebuilt, that this is a great time for us to reopen the national dialogue on race.
Calvin Butts, Reverend Butts, in Atlanta, are you optimistic about that? You've seen where the issue of poverty and continuing racial issues have sat in the national consciousness in recent years, not very high. Do you think that this will push these back center stage? I see Congress is putting off now legislation that would have ended the estate tax that Republicans have pushed very strongly for, that would allow people who've accumulated wealth to hang on to that wealth from generation to generation. There's one immediate impact, at least a delay in consideration of that. Do you think that poverty and race will get a greater airing, or is this a moment's attention and the storm leaves and our attention moves away as well?
It will largely depend upon how we can keep this, how effective we can be in keeping this on the front burner for the American public. All of this has the potential of being lost with the proper spin by some media, and all of this has the potential of being lost with the proper positioning of the administration by its handlers. So, for instance, the president can show up in Baton Rouge with a token, T.D. Jakes, and make it appear as if he has somehow captured the attention of the African-American population, that he is doing the right thing. If that is allowed to continue without our consistent and very direct response, yes, it can be forgotten, and there are those who want us to forget. For example, another indication of what I consider to be the race slant of this administration, this particular administration, the election in Florida that Bush stole. That clearly depended heavily upon the exploitation of black people. And many people, considering the numbers of black votes he was able to get, even though slightly larger, but larger in this last election, seem to have let that pass or not remembered it as we should have.
Of course, so, President Bush would say it was a mess, but he won. But we understand that that debate goes on.
Mm-hmm. I'm always, if you meet a minister who's not hopeful and optimistic, you need to get away from him. But I hope burns eternal and springs eternal. So I'm hoping that this event not only exposes the tragedies of race and class, but it also helps us to recall the kind of moral high ground that Martin Luther King Jr. stood on when he pointed to race. But he also pointed to class when he was leading the Poor People's Campaign to Washington to say that poverty and race go hand in hand. But there is a large pocket in this country of whites who are extremely poor, who have been fooled by the cruel hoax of race to rail against their black brothers and sisters when we are both really in the same boat. Mm-hmm. And we have a common enemy, which is really represented by this administration, rich, fat cats who sit at the top and really don't care about the poor.
Of course, George Bush's supporters will put it quite a different way, saying they've got the keys to rev up the economy. On the other hand, in the aftermath of these images and the reality of growing national poverty, you've got people very outspoken. Kanye West, the outspoken rapper at the NBC fundraiser last week, saying straight up, George Bush doesn't care about black people. The images didn't look good, but is this an issue of racism, or not. Calvin Butts, Robert Pratt, please stand by. I want to turn to Washington, D.C. We're joined by Jason DeParle, reporter for the New York Times, author of the terrific book, American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. Jason, thanks for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
We're good, and we're trying to figure out exactly what to make of the images we saw in the last week. They were black faces, and there was a lot of poverty right along this Gulf Coast. Is it just the sort of dressing down that the region took because of Katrina that makes it look so bad, or are we being exposed to something here that we've just turned a blind eye on for years?
Well, you've been talking up to now about the great racial and class disparities we've seen in the immediate days after the storm. I think one thing we all need to keep our eye on is how that story carries forward in the diaspora of the people from New Orleans. I think there's an ongoing potential for racial conflict in this as people relocate and resettle in new cities, and you have kids going to new schools, and you've got people moving into to new neighborhoods, displaced people who are already have great reason to be upset, and I think there's an issue for a lot of rub going forward.
We've spent a good deal of time looking at that issue just in recent days, but we're trying to get a sense of how these images fit into the national picture. Is this is it a gross misrepresentation to take these images from one week in a hurricane-battered New Orleans and say, we've got a problem with race and poverty in this country, or is this something we just haven't paid attention to during the boom go-go 90s and the George Bush years, and now it's plopped right in front of us unavoidably?
Oh, I would say poverty was quite a topic of conversation for much of the 1990s in ways positive and negative. There was a huge discussion about welfare laws. There were large expansions of wage subsidies for low-income people. There was an active expansion of some parts of the safety net, large expansions of child care, and there was a constriction of part of the safety net, but the subject was very much in the air. I think it began to fall off the air with the passage of the new welfare laws in 1996, which kind of removed a political impetus for having a conversation about poverty, and then, of course, the economy moved, so the poverty rates were falling. I think what we've had for the last 5 years or so is a kind of silence on the subject. And honestly, as somebody who's studied race and poverty in the United States for the past two decades, I've been astonished at how much everyone is focused on the race and class aspect of this tragedy. I mean, certainly one could imagine the conversation having gone in different directions.
But, such as?
Oh, well, there's a devastation of a whole city. I mean, the race and class aspect of it is certainly important, but my God, a major American city has been wiped out. There are other things happening at the same time. I think the fact that we've seen so much focus on the subject speaks to the sort of an ongoing sense of national concern that this is an issue in our society, and it's been laid bare in a very disturbing way in the last few days. For all the obvious terrible tragedy of it, make me think that it could be the inauguration of a productive conversation about poverty in the country. That there was nothing. If you had asked me 2 weeks ago, is there anything that could propel the subject of race and poverty onto the front pages of every newspaper and every TV show, I would have said no, it was beyond my conception. But here it is.
Robert Pratt, we've just got half a minute before the break, but I have to say, if you live in the glow of the TV screen and the general media coverage and ads in our country, the face of poverty rarely seems to break through. In my perception.
Yes, well, I mean, this is something that we've been hit very hard with in this past week. The situation, as you look at it and you watch it unfold before your very eyes, you are haunted by the images of people living in these squalid conditions, and as the point has already been made previously on the show, that these conditions existed well before Katrina hit, but they had just been exposed very painfully most recently in the aftermath of this hurricane, and we see firsthand close up the devastating effect that this has had on a city and on the country, I think.
Mm. Robert Pratt, Calvin Butts, Jason DePaul, please stand by. I have to take a short break. Kanye West takes us out. We'll turn to our calls right after the break. 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Still, people lose hands, legs, arms for real. Little was known of Sierra Leone and how it connects to the diamonds we own. When I speak of diamonds in a song, I ain't talking about the ones that we own. I'm talking about Rockefeller, my home.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, bicon.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about race and poverty on the front burner in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. You can join the conversation. What is the message in the crowds of poor black victims of Katrina? What's the message of this storm that goes across color lines? And will issues of race and poverty be shoved offstage again in America, or is this just too shocking to ignore? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in this hour from Atlanta, Georgia, by Reverend Calvin Butts. He is pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York. Robert Pratt joins us from Athens, Georgia. He's professor of African American history at the University of Georgia. And from Washington, Jason DePaul, reporter for the New York Times and author of American Dream. Right now, Marcia's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Marcia, you're on the air.
Yes, I am.
What are you thinking? What are you thinking, Marcia?
Well, I think I'm a little frustrated by the tone of the conversation because I am very concerned. I'm a native of South Alabama, from one of the poorest counties in South Alabama.
All right.
My family and people around them have been impacted by Hurricane Ivan and then Hurricane Dennis,
mm-hmm.
and certainly we're blessed to have been spared the worst of Hurricane Katrina and are now providing food and shelter to people from Mississippi and Louisiana.
Good for you. What's your frustration here, Marcia?
Well, my frustration is, as was stated a little bit earlier, is that this has become such a surprise to people that there's poverty in these states. The statistics have shown year after year that Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi are among the poorest states in the country, and I do not in any way dispute that that has a disparate impact on African-American and people of color. I mean, these are states where 50% or more of the population is African-American, unlike Iowa, where I live now,
mm-hmm.
where it's very hard to find a face of color anywhere outside of the college communities. So, of course, when you show the pictures of people being impacted, there is going to be a disproportionate number of African-Americans compared to what most people see around them every day.
But what are you suggesting by that, that this is just the natural order and we ought to be fine with it?
Absolutely not. What I'm frustrated by, though, is that I see so many people using this as an opportunity to attack the Bush administration. There has been no conversation on this call by any of the experts about the fact that the African-American mayor of New Orleans, who of all people was certainly aware of the high levels of poverty, the people who had no means to get out of his city. There were city buses that were left idle that could have been used to evacuate those people days before this hurricane. When Hurricane Dennis came through, which thankfully bypassed much of Mobile, the governor of Alabama did forced evacuations more than 48 hours in advance and took a lot of criticism for that. But Ray Nagin did not do forced evacuations until less than 24 hours ahead.
So you're saying look closer to home, look at your own mayor, New Orleans.
Yes, and certainly then the governor, the Democratic governor of the state of Louisiana, and Louisiana has some of the strangest laws in the country due to their French heritage that do in some ways prohibit the governor from stepping in sometimes when parish officials take precedence. But she fought turning over the National Guard to the feds.
So Governor Blanco, Democrat, look close to home. Marcia, I think we've got that, and let us pick it up. Calvin Butts, caller, says, look, you've got a black mayor in New Orleans. He could have ordered people out of there sooner. Let's not dump all this on at Washington's feet.
I think that the mayor, in his own frustration, articulated that the resources to really handle the kind of mass evacuation. We're just not there. I mean, you can tell people to leave their homes and try to force them out, but they don't have in New Orleans the adequate police force to enforce that. One of his frustrations, articulated not only by him but by his chief of police or the deputy chief. Secondly, you have to take a look at the fact that they were talking about what happens after people realize that this tremendous storm is coming. And the mayor couldn't fix the levee by himself. That's federal dollars that are required to do that. And the governor stated clearly that she wanted to have more control over the National Guard. That's an argument between the president and the governor, but I think that all governors want to be able, who are familiar with their state and what needs to be done, to be able to the last possible moment to direct the National Guard and try to steer them in the right direction. Finally, let me say that New Orleans does not account for my lack of regard for this administration. It's the fact that the resources needed for poor people, black and white, were being used to do other things when they should have been used to help Americans. I'm from New York. I watched 9/11. I was at the site. I saw the immediate response of the president, not from in the air, but on the ground, hugging firemen, making speeches. You know, I watched the money pour in and how it was distributed. And I saw a cleanup there that happened in remarkable time because the resources of this nation were directly focused on New York. They have not been until recently, and still not to the extent that they can be, on New Orleans.
Let me take another call. Adair is calling from Boston. Hi, Adair. You're on the air.
Yes, I think Reverend Butch just hit on it, but what I would really want to underscore is that the resources of the nation in the 9/11 case was really being channeled toward the wealthy. In this particular case, the resources were not channeled toward the impoverished. We must never forget, forfeit, or falsify the past. What we have happening here is a situation where white men are in charge of the U.S. Senate. And the wealth of this nation has been built upon the backs of the poor. And so we are never going to have a situation where poverty in America is going to get addressed because it's going to require that those who have wealth give up something. That's what the problem is. So we have persons such as Trent Lott, who I'm told was affected by this horrific situation as well. But when he walks around thumbing his nose and not pushing for policy for the impoverished, how can we expect that the poor will ever be in a situation to better themselves? They weren't able to evacuate because they didn't have the resources.
Adair, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Jason DePaul, how about it? The President Bush's comment that he looked forward to Trent Lott rebuilding his lovely home there in Pascagoula on the Mississippi coast has gotten a lot of attention. I dare say would call that a reflection of a general attitude in Washington not attuned to issues of poverty. You point out that they got a lot of attention around welfare reform in the 90s and more, I guess.
Yeah, there's an interesting bookend there. The welfare law that was passed in 1996 has been celebrated, perhaps over-celebrated, by both sides as an incredibly successful piece of social legislation. It expired in 2002, and Congress has not even been able to reauthorize the law. So states are running their welfare programs on a series of, I think it's up to 10 short-term extensions of the welfare law in a climate of great uncertainty. That's just one small example of the larger phenomenon, which is how far off the front burner poverty issues are. Even a law that both sides agree is working, they can't get together to reauthorize. So I think this has been a great jolt, and it provides some opening for members of Congress, for advocates, for others who have concerns about the state of the social safety net to advocate for their policies.
Walter's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Walter, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm an African-American guy, and, I didn't vote for Bush, but our people, our leaders got to quit talking about Bush did this. I mean, I'm upset, and the first thing come and say is racism. Hey, like that lady said, that guy, Mayor in Louisiana, He was the mayor, man. Hey, if you got power like that, you help your people out. All our people around here got power. But when it comes to helping our people out, we don't want to help our people out. It's all about the government supposed to do this.
So are you saying it's wrong to charge racism in the wake of Katrina?
Right about now, yes, it is. Yes, it is. I mean, didn't expect this. Did nobody expect how big this hurricane was going to be? And, yeah, it was sad to see that situation. But, look, right about now, like my pastor said, it's not time for that, man. These people need help down here. And the only thing I'm hearing from our people, and I'm an African-American people, I'm upset. I know it's racism as this here. But right about now, we don't need a call for this, man. They need help and quit hollering about racism and all that. And when our people, I mean, I'm just upset. And Kanye West, hey, this guy's a rapper. How much money all these rappers who got all this money go through? Quit talking about what the government doing to us. And they got all that money. They need to go down there and contribute and put all the money they got and quit buying all.
We hear it. Reach for your wallet, Kanye, and pitch in. Robert Pratt, there's an African-American clearly upset by what he's seen, as many people are, but says it's not useful right now to raise the issue of race here. It should be all about relief.
Well, you know, the sad reality is that, you know, we have many of these issues. I think what the caller perhaps is expressing is a sort of a frustration that many of us have expressed for many years over a continual discussion of these issues. And, you know, I'll be frank, you know, trying to look at these issues and discussing them in terms of race, these things are often very difficult for people. They're often very, very painful. Ours is a society that, for a large part, is still in tremendous denial about the pervasiveness of racism. I'm looking at these images. I watch them, as I think we all did as a nation, glued to the television, switching from one channel to the other, looking at the poor, inadequate response. And I am desperately, as someone who teaches and has studied African-American history, I sat there desperately seeking some alternative explanation for the way the things played out, hoping not to say, well, this is another example of racism. But see, it may be more than blatant racism, and I think that in a large sense it is. We have unaddressed issues of poverty. The civil rights movement of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, for all that it did, for all of the advances that came about as a result of it, it did not address the issue of poverty in this country. It did not result in a major redistribution of the wealth. And that was the great failure, I think, of the civil rights movement. And ours is a society now that tends to shy away from discussions of race because we find them often too painful to deal with. And I think this is part of the frustration. But if you look at the federal government's response, I think most people would have to conclude that the response was inadequate, that it was too little, too late. And, you know, at the end of the day, it will be up to each individual to reach his or her own conclusion as to how you could explain that inadequate response.
The why behind all that. Let me get another call here, if I may, Robert Pratt. Maxime is calling from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Maxime. You're on the air.
Hi. The reason why I'm calling is there are several points that I want to hit on.
Let's hear it.
The first one is 9/11. 9/11 consisted of 10 city blocks. Do they actually think that they could have evacuated New York? It never would have happened. So I would not say to compare this to 9/11.
All right.
Another aspect is the rapper that said what he said.
Kanye West saying President Bush, George Bush, doesn't care about black people.
Right. And to say that he gave a permit to shoot black people. I thought that was a little bit ludicrous because rescue workers had to be taken off of rescuing people to go take care of these people that were shooting at them. That was somebody's mom, sister, brother, that possibly could have died because somebody had to go and take care of these people that were shooting weapons at them.
Our time grows short. Let us pick that point up, Maxime, if I may. Reverend Butts, how do you explain the gunfire on relief workers in New Orleans, and there was a point at which people were pulling out food because they were hungry, but there was also clearly just some plain kind of pillaging here.
Well, I think, first of all, the reports that we have received here from those who were there and clergy persons who have been talking to those who were there is that was frustration also, that people were very upset when they saw relief workers and rescue operations bypassing black people and going to pick up whites. And they just became so angry when they saw this over and over that some of them, I guess, in their frustration, fired a weapon. Once again, this is very frustrating when you see yourself being there for hours and days and seeing rescue workers and relief workers bypassing you for someone else. Not once, not twice, but several times. Something else I want to say is, you know, one would be surprised at what can be done. You know, you say evacuate New York City. Well, that's Manhattan Island, and you've got to have a concept of what New York City is.
Yeah, the scale.
But you can do some interesting things when you have prepared and when you know what's coming. And one of the issues here is that knowing that the city was vulnerable, nothing was done. And the work
not enough was done. Reverend Butts, our time is so short, and I want to get one more call from Louisiana, if you'd be so kind. Jessica is calling from Monroe, Louisiana. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air.
Hi. Dr. Pratt, this is Jessica Perkins. I'm a student in Dr. Pratt's department at the University of Georgia, and I'm from New Orleans.
And what do you see? What do you think about the race and poverty issues that have been exposed here, Jessica?
Well, I definitely, you know, really agree with everything I've heard this morning, and it certainly isn't a surprise to someone being from New Orleans. And it, you know, obviously it's sad, and I am frustrated with the administration's response. But my real question is, I've just returned from, I'm headed back to Georgia from northern Louisiana, where my family evacuated to. And, you know, I've spent some time at shelters and at distribution centers this week. But my real question is, as a teacher, how do we address this with our students, and especially at a university like the University of Georgia that is so largely white and upper middle class? How do we address this now, but also continue the dialogue so that this isn't just something that students watch on CNN for a week and donate some money and it's over.
To take some learning forward here, Jessica, we've just got a minute. Let us pick that up. Robert Pratt, here's someone from your community asking, you've looked at the history, how these things come and go from the limelight. How can this be kept front and center? Do you see action following up on what we've seen?
Well, let me say hello to my former student, Jessica. Thank you for calling in. Yes, I know. I mean, it is our hope that these issues will not fade into obscurity once we get past this period. Certainly, as I said earlier, and I have been very moved by the outpouring of support that has come from private people in this country, white and black. And I think, you know, for as much negative that has come out of it, for all of the devastation, for the tremendous psychological toll that this will take on countless lives as people try to rebuild what's left of their lives and try to start anew, that we've got to find a way to make sure that this issue gets the kind of attention that it deserves. You know, we can't talk too much about these issues. I know some people are tired of hearing about them, but it seems to me that the only way we're ever to move forward as a nation
is to talk it through, and it's on the table now, and the clock runs down on us. Robert Pratt, at the University of Georgia, thank you for joining us. Calvin Butts, pastor at the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York, thank you for your time. And Jason DePaul, reporter with the New York Times, thanks so much for your time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.